This is 16.9 The Podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 16.9 has been covering the digital signage industry for more than 11 years. First online, and now it's a podcast. We cover what's new and interesting, and we filter out all the BS. This podcast gives listeners a chance to hear at length from people and companies who are making a real mark in this industry with new ideas or just old-fashioned hard work and smarts. You can listen to episodes online, get it from iTunes or Google Play, or use your favorite podcast app to pull down the RSS feed. I know a lot of our listeners fire up episodes while they're stuck in traffic or taking the dog for a walk. We now have a companion podcast called Projects, hosted by my longtime industry friend Michael Tutton. That show is all about digging deep on the creative and tech behind landmark projects like the Cosmo Lobby in Las Vegas. You can find that at dsprojects.podbean.com. 16.9 is sponsored and gratefully supported by ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. I've been very big for a long time now on the use of data to drive better messaging to digital signage screens, whether that's for advertising or for making factory floors more efficient, and pretty much everything in between. So I was really happy to learn that when I was in Amsterdam for ISE a few weeks ago, Dan Dawson from Grand Visual was also going to be there. His production and creative technology company in London is one of the real innovators in using data in interesting, relevant ways for digital out-of-home advertising. Grand Visual campaigns have won a stack of awards, and the team works with major, major clients like McDonald's, Disney, Pepsi, and Google. They've done some great augmented reality work like the Green Giant in Grand Central Station and aliens marauding at bus stops on the streets of London. We talk about the process, the technology, what works, and what's just buzz. My little interview hideaway was unavailable when we met, so we hid behind a bunch of shipping crates at the convention hall and hoped a forklift didn't rumble over.
So thank you. Why don't you tell me what you do, what your role is with Grand Visual, and why you're here.
I'm Chief Creative Technology Officer at Grand Visual. Been there since the start. Neil and I founded the company 12 years ago. We set up as a production company looking at the digital out-of-home space, so working with, back then, media owners and agencies looking at how we can help create content. Creative agencies were struggling with this new weird format that was essentially just a TV turned on its end.
That was really early days.
Like, it was really early days.
How did you sort of come up with the idea to do this? And I suspect it was a little painful at first because nobody understood what it was.
Correct. I mean, there's a, you know, I've always been into the, I'm a creative technologist, so I was actually, I did a graphic design degree at Art College at St. Martin's in London, but was always more interested in the digital side. Mm-hmm. So there's always been a bit of maths around the stuff that we do. So having a look at this space and seeing, certainly on the escalators back then, Tottenham Court Road was the first one, seeing the maths around multi-screen content, being able to move things from screen to screen, excited us. So we have obviously evolved as the market's evolved. We're now 40 people. We've got offices in London and in New York. We still service the same industry and beyond. Obviously, digital out of home has grown since in the last 12 years. So transportation, retail, shopping malls, to theme parks and attractions and one-off events. We're creating content for all of those spaces in the digital out-of-home world. Sometimes it merges into the display world, into mobile, but at the heart of it, if there's not a digital out-of-home screen, we're not really that interested in the projects, to be honest. We've got a number of client direct relationships who trust us with their work globally. Warner Brothers is one of them, and Disney, all the different departments of Disney trust us with various parts of their...
Was it almost like an agency of record sort of relationship, or not quite?
We're preferred partners in terms of anything digital at home. Right. So in both instances, we're delivering international campaigns for them. So we just did one with Walt Disney Studios in October last year that went to 20 countries. We've got another one coming in May with Walt Disney Studios. But our relationship with the Mouse started with Disney Parks back in 2010.
Okay.
So it's kind of grown since then, really.
So do you behave like an agency?
I think we behave like an intelligent production company.
Okay.
We, rather than just being at the end of the line in terms of a production company, there's some intelligent thinking around the stuff that we do. We've created tools that have changed the market. The content that we create for Digital at Home is broken up into one of three pillars, really. So you've got linear, where we're reversioning content, so print assets, trailer assets, or anything.
Add some motion,
whether it's full motion, subtle motion, or sometimes static, and sending it out. Within that, we also do some at smart linear stuff where we're doing location-specific content, but it's delivered linear. Mm-hmm. So maybe a localized call to action, or it may be something that is specific to that location in terms of the call to action or something. Or, you know, if it's on a specific screen in a specific location, it might be directing you to the nearest store or something.
Right.
But it's still delivered in a linear way. In 2009, we launched our Open Loop platform, which is our ability to dynamically update copy across all different screens and media owners, shapes, sizes of format. So it's a kind of, it's a content management system that sits above the regular scheduling systems that the media owners employ. So mm-hmm. whether you're using Scala or BroadSign or BrightSign or anything,
whatever,
Venus,
yeah.
you know, they're all out there, or some WebOS thing, we can deliver updatable content to screens through their media owner systems.
That was, again, something very, very early.
It was early.
That must have taken a little bit of explaining to various people.
It did, and you know, those early days of we didn't even call it dynamic then, we just wanted to do something that was a bit more time-specific
relevant
to the audience at the time. So as we launched it, we thought this is actually a big step change for the market, and we need to package this up and be able to sell this. Mm-hmm. So that's how we kind of gave birth to Open Loop, which has been, you know, copied the industry over with a couple of our competitors coming later into the market with similar type products. You know,
right.
A cloud-based web solution that able to talk to digital signage systems that you can use data to update copy.
Mm-hmm.
So we call that dynamic in our world. And then we've got interactive as well, so we're doing touchscreen,
right.
Face recognition, vehicle recognition, all sorts of stuff that's interesting, you know, with the weird and wonderful augmented mm-hmm. reality, virtual reality, you mm-hmm. name it. Could be sitting in an experiential area or on an existing media owner screen that has a touchscreen on it. We're creating we're software engineering for the market as well.
Right. Is it a lot easier now to get at data than, say, it was in 2009?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there is more data around and it's more publicly available. You know, in 2010 was the biggest campaign at the launch of Open Loop, and that was for Nike around the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And back then it was as simple as they wanted to, at the end of every game during the World Cup, they wanted to write a tactical copy line and push it out there to screens that was relevant to the game that just played. So Open Loop allowed them to do that. It's very simple. Typing into a kind of what you see is what you get web interface and say, right, that's it, that's what I want to push out, and sending
right.
that out.
So sorry once again, England.
Yeah, exactly. we've got a bit of a reputation of when we're tied to a national sporting event, that the sporting gods determine that the team that we are supporting fail. So that was England in the World Cup, England in the Ashes in the cricket when we got whitewashed 5-0. So anytime Open Loop's associated to a national
kiss of
football.
Death.
Yeah, it's the kiss of death. So always put your money on the other team when Open Loop are giving you. So yeah, I think, you know, in terms of the data that's available, we kind of bucket things up into three different data sources for our home.
Mm-hmm.
We've got local data, which, you know, we know the location, we know the time of day, and we know the active audience in front of the screen, if, you know, certainly in the UK with all of the data that's available to us through Root.
Right.
And then obviously third party data that we can buy in, sports scores, weather forecasts, whatever you like. And then the third one is business owned data. So we do a lot of work with Google, we do a lot of work with people like the big financial institutions
mm-hmm.
or with Disney around numbers of people visiting attractions, and we can use that data to help inform our creative.
Right.
So yeah, we've taken some big strides over the last 3 years with the various amounts of data that we can use, and we've used
mm-hmm.
everything from, as I say, weather forecasting all the way through to how many items of a certain thing have been sold and being able to change the creative based on that.
Is it a crawl, walk, run kind of thing when you're working with data, that particularly with a new client where you kind of have to ease your way into it with them?
We've tried to simplify it a bit in our sales process, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting with the agencies talking about what's possible,
mm-hmm.
and we're doing a lot of education to the market as well through the creative agencies and through the media agencies about those three buckets of data.
Right.
And trying to break them up into different things and trying to showcase some of the things that maybe inform creative or just inform media as well. So trying to understand how real-time insights can inform a media decision as well as the creative. And I think that's what we're going to see as we move towards the programmatic landscape of digital at home.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2015, we did the programmatic test with Google for Digital Out of Home in the UK, and we ran across premium inventory across multiple media owners using live availability. If it was there and we had an active audience, we would take the slot, and we split that up across three different Google brands who were vying for similar audiences, and connected the DoubleClick engine into our open loop platform. So we became the Digital Out of Home publisher within DoubleClick, so that we could make executive decisions on the fly, serve ads, and report back on them as well. And that model, the programmatic guaranteed model, is the model that we're going to see moving forward for Digital Out of Home, certainly in the first instance. I don't think it will be these kind of race to the bottom prices or real-time bidding. It's going to be a guaranteed model where we're saying, where media owners are guaranteed an amount of money by an agency, and content can be triggered on the fly with live availability and reporting on the back end. But the reporting on the back end is by far and away the most important thing for the programmatic future of Out of Home. So all the data in the world can inform our creative, but if we don't know that creative has played and we can't debit an amount of money from the credit pot, then programmatic dies very quickly for Out of Home. And I think that, you know, we have to combat some of the things that we've seen in other medium, where, you know, the kind of fraudulent behaviors of some of the publishers, where you've got bots recording views.
Sure.
We just can't do that for Out of Home, because we have, it's of the way it's sold in terms of impressions, or we need to be able to prove that an ad has played at that location at that time, and potentially even use that as a piece of data to inform other medium as well. So we had an ad play in a given location, let's say in Times Square, bad example, maybe in Waterloo Station in London. You may want to retarget consumers who may have been in that area on their mobiles through iAds or something, or their maybe IP lookups of browsers in that location with a continuation of your story. So I think the data that Out of Home can give to the rest of media might be an interesting starting point for you know, that payout information to trigger other content.
It sounds, in certain respects, like you're saying, there seems to be a stunt factor to, or novelty factor to, some of the digital out-of-home things I've seen that are based on real-time data, and, you know, look what we did. It sounds like you're saying the real hidden secret of this, the real value, is kind of boring stuff. It's just being highly contextual.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we've worked with Talent Outdoor, a specialist in the UK, on a number of campaigns to try and understand the value of contextual messaging and relevancy time messaging. And they've got some fantastic research around how consumers react to relevant copy, how much more recall they get. So, that, you know, they're doing some fairly traditional polls, to be honest, where people stand around, like, what advertising did you see today? Did you feel like, what did you feel like when you saw it, you know?
Right.
But, you know, it's a double-digit increase in awareness of a campaign when there's relevant copy to that audience at the time, whether it's due to train delays in a location or whether it's advertising breakfast at breakfast time. It doesn't matter. If you can be contextually relevant with your copy, consumers are going to notice it more.
So what would be a good example of that? Yeah, I know you're talking about trains and so on.
So as part of the programmatic test that we did with Google, we used some data sources to give us real-time audience insight. Now, that didn't inform the creative and update the creative, but it did let us know there was more people in the area and they would be in a certain mindset and it was at a certain time of day. So it helped us make executive decisions. So it didn't say, there are train delays, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you must be hungry. That would be too obvious, you know. We're taking these decisions, we're saying, okay, Root has told us that the indexing for the target audience is this at the moment. But our real-time audience insight tools say, or data says, well, there are train delays, so there will be more people in that station, on that station concourse, so we should advertise because we're going to get good value for money here, because the currency hasn't changed. It's still going to cost us this amount, but we're going to get more audience. Now, it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's raining outside. People are going to have longer to wait for their train. Which of these three products should we select? And one of them was a food-based YouTube channel. So we made an executive decision to show the food message around the what to have for dinner tonight, what to cook for dinner. Meaning that people would go to the Marks and Spencers in the station and potentially buy ingredients to do something like that. So it's kind of...
And how do you track that through? How do you know that you had this double-digit impact.
So that was definitely a talent job. That's the outdoor specialist. They're there to, I mean, essentially what an outdoor specialist is a data analyst. They're looking at data all the time, looking at locations, looking at audience numbers, and their research team goes away and works out how many more people would have been there. You know, they look at national statistics and stuff to try and find that out. Another good example of it would have been when it started to rain, we started to upweight the campaign indoors. So while it's still digital at home, we were looking at indoor in shopping malls rather than outside shopping malls. It was raining, less people outside. You know, you can make some common sense decisions around the data that's available to you. So that's a good example. And then another one we did for, in the US actually, for Google Play, which we're hoping to bring over here, is we created 5,000 pieces of copy or something for different play, their curated playlists that sit on the Google Music Store. Mm-hmm. And we had locations around the country in the US, different cities, all kind of roadside billboard, digital billboards. And we were looking at different data sources to tell us what the traffic was like on those stretches of road. Mm-hmm. And then the time of day and the day of the week were used as data sources as well. And we switched the copy based on, it's Monday morning, you should listen to this message, or you're stuck in traffic, you can listen to this. We did things like we reduced the length of the headline when there was fast moving traffic because people have less to read, and you know, obviously they're focusing on the road. Mm-hmm. But if you're moving faster, you read less in the time you've got to see the billboard. So we're using some of those data sources to intelligently update copy. So it's quite interesting stuff.
There's a bunch of costs involved in putting this podcast together, so I'm very grateful for the support this podcast will get from our new and sole sponsor, ScreenFeed. Here's founder and CEO, Jeremy Gavin.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. As content people, we love great content, and we think Dave's doing a great job with this 16.9 podcast, which is why we've offered to sponsor it. If you'd like to see the content that we create on a daily basis, head over to screenfeed.com and check it out. Let us know if we can help you in any project you're working on. And do me a favor, if you don't find what you're looking for, shoot me an email at jeremy@screenfeed.com. I'm always interested in new ways we can help. Now back to the podcast.
I'm curious, in the signage industry, you've been around it a long time now. Video analytics a decade ago was being marketed as something that you could use to trigger content based on who's in front of the screen. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've ever seen that outside of a trade show actually being used. Is it something that you would actually apply, or is it just...
We have used it on the back of campaigns. You know, we've done certainly on interactive campaigns using facial recognition to deliver a coffee when you smile on I think it was for Blue Monday, so the most miserable day of the year. So we have used some of those recognition technologies to do things. I think so. You know, we talked to the guys at Quividy yesterday, and we've used Quividy to understand location information before. So we've worked with some of the shopping mall owners around what audience is active at the time. And we've done some monitoring over the course of a week or so to understand how the market moves in that space. There's been a couple of campaigns in the UK that use gender recognition as a thing, you know, just upweighting a message based on the number of people in front of the screen. Is it going to be, you know, is it a game changer? No, I don't think so, because I mean, for me, out of home is still a broadcast message. You're just as, like, just because our data says there are more women in front of the screen than men at 3 o'clock in the afternoon doesn't mean you should stop advertising to men. And I think sometimes there can be that over reliance on data or legacy data. The more real time we can get it, the better the message can be, for sure. I don't know, I just think that some of them are a bit gimmicky,
right?
And that can be a damage to what we do, I think.
So you're a creative technologist. We're standing here at ISC. You've walked around Hall 8, which is the digital signage pavilion or hall, and there's lots of big display companies here showing their latest and greatest. What's the stuff that brings you here that intrigues you? Or
I guess it's always good to see the updates. I mean, we get them anyway. The big companies like BroadSigns and Scala, so we're talking to them on an almost daily basis anyway with their support teams, because we're always developing content for Digital App Home. We have to be up to date with the latest software. We've built a digital signage replica system in our office in London that enables us to test content in the way that media owners test content. Mm-hmm. So we've got replica systems of JCDecaux and of Clear Channel and Experian and Ocean Outdoor,
right.
And some of the US vendors as well, to make sure that when we're supplying dynamic copy that it will work first time around. Mm-hmm. So it's good to see those guys here, and you know that they're people that we've dealt with for years. We've been in this market a long time, so mm-hmm. tend to find lots of people stay in the market, and we know them. So it's good to catch up with people, see what's new, see what's right. coming as well, and just spend some time out of the office talking about this stuff. We always love looking at new screens, you know, the bigger screens or the smaller pitch LEDs, and seeing mm-hmm. what's possible. We've been looking at some of the transparent stuff. We've pitched in a number of times things that can go in the windows, things that can, you know, we've done lots of augmented reality campaigns in bus stops where it's, you know, people always ask us for the hologram look, which is, it's not a hologram. It's
yeah.
not a hologram.
It's one of the most abused terms
oh, yeah.
in technology.
Yeah, it's very funny. We do a lot of augmented reality. We've done it in bus stops all around the world, to be honest. So it's good to see how display technologies are coming on. Mm-hmm. But the biggest thing for me is just it's more about resolution coming along than the actual screens themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Great, you know, just went and took a picture of a nice 94-inch LG monitor that I really like the look of for a signage system, but it's 4K and that's great. That's what makes it appealing to us. You know.
Right.
Where might we suggest it's used for a project? I don't know. You know, we liked it. We've got an internal department at Grand Visual, which is kind of a R&D, call it GV Labs, where we come to events like this and pick up leaflets, find out, you know, been through the audio hall to look at interesting speakers or speaker solutions, mm-hmm. looking at ways that we can adapt existing digital out-of-home networks with a bit of audio for a special project. Mm-hmm. But for us, it's all about kind of cataloguing all these things and holding them in the bank. Mm-hmm. Coming back to them at a later date when the project's right. You mm-hmm. know, what we would never ever do is try and shoehorn a piece of technology in because we want to use it. The technology has to be right for the creative message.
Yeah. A mistake made all the time. Right?
Absolutely. You know, I've lost count of the number of briefs I've had in front of me that say, I want a media first, I want to use this piece of technology. But why? It's got no relevance to your creative message at all. Let's not do that.
Yeah.
We always talk about the perfect marriage between creative and technology. Mm-hmm. If you're far too technical, the creative message will be lost. And if you're if you're way too creative, and no technology, people will kind of, again, you may lose the audience at some point as well. Mm-hmm. So we have to find, on a creative technology project, we've got to find that perfect equilibrium, the marriage mm-hmm. of creative to technology. The other thing we get in a brief is, what's the one piece of technology you've always wanted to use on a campaign, but a client hasn't had the balls to do it? And like, it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
Yes, we've got a list of technology that we like, but I want to read a brief and understand whether this piece of technology is relevant to your brief response at all. Otherwise, you know, we could just do a really nice linear piece and you could sell exactly the same number of products that you're yeah. intending to do. Or we could do a really nice dynamic project. It's not a media first, it's a media thousandth.
Yeah.
But it's proven and it works and the audience are going to love it. So that's what you should do. So mm-hmm. we're really keen on responding to briefs in the right way, with the right technology, with the right pillar of delivery for us, whether it be linear, dynamic, or interactive.
Yeah. Yeah, I was made me think about the Apple stores and how they put in this giant fine pixel pitch LED wall in the back of some of their flagship stores. And they could have done the whole circus comes to town with, you know, incredible fast-moving graphics and everything else, but instead they just put basically hardware porn up there,
yeah.
a slow-moving Apple Watch and slow-moving iPhone and so on, and you look at it and go, that's perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it's use of the technology that's important, mm-hmm. right? So you can have, you know, so we looked at some of the HTC stuff on display here, actually, the headset VR, amazing stuff, and you can see why a client would be interested in doing something like that.
Yeah.
It's a great experience for a single user. Is it worth it for digital at home?
You know, not in the slightest.
Cost per thousand is going to be ridiculous. No, I don't think so. I think, you know, we need to think of ways that are going to, in a very fast-moving technology world where mm-hmm. everyone in our market is aware of new technologies. It's on the news, it's on their new Facebook news feeds, it's everywhere. Oh, that's cool. Wow, that's brilliant. Is it right for a campaign? You don't know until you see mm-hmm. the campaign brief. And that's it.
Have you used much social media?
Lots of the stuff we do touches social media, either before or after campaign. So and social media using user-generated content as part of our campaigns has been happening for a number of years. Some of the more experience-led things that we do in terms of a large augmented reality stunt where you virtually meet Mickey Mouse in Times Square, mm-hmm. we're capturing that and sending it back to the user for them to share on their social networks. And obviously if they share it through our portal, then right. we're helping track that in terms of Facebook impressions or whatever. Mm. So yes, some of the more interactive things that we do touch social networks. Okay. But for the most part on a dynamic project, it's all about bringing in content, gaining the approval from the user to use it in our open loop platform, and then being able to push that out to the wider audience.
That approvals piece, that sounds complicated.
It is. I mean, but there are a lot of moderation tools out there, and mm-hmm. we use a couple of different companies. Actually, we outsource that bit. There's no money in it for us, really. It's right. someone sitting at a desk going, that's a good picture. Can we contact them? Yes. And then there's lines in a database.
So that's actually happened. I take a great photo in Times Square or something like that, and you guys want to use it. You're going to send something in my direct message me
on a on a specific campaign. Yeah, it's campaign-led.
Okay.
If you are... In some instances, when you're already opting in to, you know, send us your picture, it's going on the
right.
screen. You've got to opt in anyway. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's a more public hashtag, then you need to. You know, I mean, it's just morally right to go
right.
and ask someone to use their picture. If
right.
it's a, you know, if it's a hashtag cake, I mean, everyone's posting pictures of their cake. So I'm not. You're not opting into my new product that's called Cake, and you know, your image rights are as valuable as anyone else's, so mm-hmm. you should be informed,
right?
And at least ask permission to use your picture. So mm-hmm. we are very aware of that, and I think that's really important that we stay on the right side morally,
right.
Of consumers.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about augmented reality. I've always wondered about the public take up of it, and then Pokemon Go came along, and all of a sudden there are millions of people running around madly looking at their phones.
Yeah, bumping into things.
Yeah, it
and
seems to
stopping
have
on the freeway.
Calmed way down. But I was curious if we get a general public that's now conditioned to looking at the world through their phone and actually occasionally looking up, does that make a difference and make AR more interesting as a medium?
For us, augmented reality for us in the digital out of home world is about what you can see on obviously one of the outdoor screens. So we've done things on big screens in Times Square with Mickey Mouse, or in Grand Central with high-fiving the Green Giant, or
right.
bringing aliens to the streets of London through a bus stop screen and for Pepsi Max. You know, so with all of those kind of projects, or angels landing on the station concourse in Victoria.
Right. Yeah,
that's our augmented reality in terms of digital out of home. So it's still a broadcast message. Lots mm-hmm. of people got to see one guy standing on the platform, and it was on the concourse, and it was the Lynx angel that fell, and it was branded as Lynx.
Mm-hmm.
People are more used to seeing it because of things that, like, on their mobiles or games or more headset use with, you know, everyone's got a very powerful camera in their pocket now.
Yeah.
I think people are more used to seeing it. I don't think that's it. Everything's going to be augmented reality from now on. I don't think that's the way that's going to work. It's a one-off thing. In a couple of years' time, we'll be on to the next thing.
Yeah.
We'll be on to holograms everywhere again. Or back to holograms everywhere again.
Lord. with ubiquitous connectivity and with sensors, IoT sensors going everywhere, that must be intriguing as hell for you guys.
Fantastic. This is a great show for it as well. The home automation guys, you know, we've been and spoken to a lot of people over the last 2 days, and they all wanted, are you an integrator? Well, of sorts I am, we're looking at some of the component parts that you guys are doing and going, great, that would be awesome for a project that we're going to be putting in an airport hall, or this is a really cool rain sensor. What could we do with the rain sensor that would that could trigger content? Or this is the wind sensor. We've done lots of projects with, you know, component parts. We did a foot pedal project for the launch of a new Range Rover, and it was essentially an accelerator pedal out of a new Range Rover, connected to a potentiometer. And as you depressed your foot, the roar of the engine came from a parabolic speaker above you, and it mm-hmm. made the rev counter go up on the screen. It's relatively simple.
Yeah.
It was a dimmer switch and an Arduino plugged into an existing Media Owner PC and connected to a speaker above you. You know, it's actually relatively straightforward to do,
mm-hmm.
but it was a great use of these component parts. You know, the Arduino is 30 bucks.
Yeah.
The potentiometer, $6. Obviously, the fabrication takes a lot, like making it IP66 rated and all sorts of stuff for the audience. But it's when you get to pick apart those components, you go, actually, that would be, we could use that, or we could use this, and we could change the meshes using this component part. It's fantastic. So we're looking at a project at the moment for a client where we're trying to give people a taste of the automated future of the home. And that's their big push. So we're trying to think of an installation where we may use some of these component parts. So some of the stuff that we've seen here at ISC is kind of food for thought.
Yeah.
And what we do is we've kind of, as I said, we've been adding those things to our catalogue of this is cool, taking pictures, talking to the guys, you know, getting their brochures, and documenting everything so that when it does come to a project like that, we can pick out some of those fun bits and see if they can help in the ideation process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would imagine the rise of all this is pushing a lot of these gadgets, so to speak, down to commodity pricing levels, in the same way that you can now have a micro PC, a Raspberry Pi board for $45.
Yeah.
You're going to have really inexpensive sensors and everything else that makes these kinds of projects scalable versus, I'm sure when you started 10 years ago, you would say, we could do this, and client would look at the price and say,
I'm not doing
no, we're
that.
Not.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the things I wrote about last year, actually, is that the trend that we're seeing is this on the interactive side of our projects is interactivity at scale. Mm-hmm. The ability to do what we did for Walt Disney Studios last year is 20 countries, and we were shipping out hardware and all pre-programmed, pre-loaded, ready to go. Media Runner plugs into their screens, mm-hmm. runs the test application, activates everything, and we've got real-time triggering, so we can see each screen coming to life, connected by the internet through our dashboard, and say, right, that's working. Any of them fall down, we can contact the media owner and tell them. Mm-hmm. The ability to do that on relatively inexpensive, for the most part, consumer-facing technology, it's great. You know, we were using, in some instances, using a Kinect, you know, £120, an RGB webcam, £99. And a super fast mini PC. So I mean, that's, in terms of that, as a rental cost to a client, it's great. Mm-hmm. We could push that out around the world. You know, 20 countries uptake, it's great.
So as a company that's perhaps looking at starting to use data for the first time, not really familiar with all the implications that are involved, what would you recommend? What's that piece of advice you'd give them?
The right data. For the right reason. I mean, there is so much data around. If we're doing stuff around London, there's a whole data suite that London of London data from, we call them Boris bikes. They're the bikes you can go around London on. Mm-hmm. Boris was the mayor when they came to London. So. But there's lots of data around Boris bikes, where, you know, what's the average journey and all that kind of stuff. Departures and arrivals of trains, planes, buses. All of that data is available to you, and most of it's public data, and you can use it. But why are you using it? Is it right for the creative message? Is it right for your audience triggering? Mm-hmm. I think for the most part, the data has become standardized, so you're either going to find it as RSS, XML, or JSON, which means that you can use it and consolidate and push out. Anyone new to the market and just wants to start using data for an unknown reason should first go backwards and say, why are we using this data?
Yeah.
What should we use it for? And how is it going to inform my creative? I wrote a piece, again, last year called The Infinity Loop, which is how data insights are going to inform the future of the programmatic landscape, because that data insight is going to inform the media buy and also could potentially trigger content.
Yeah.
And that content could also inform the data again to say I've played, and you know, we can start to look at how a campaign lifecycle can live on potentially forever. We call it the infinite loop. It's quite interesting.
And Grand Visual has a blog, right?
We do. We've got a news feed run by Lisa. We're constantly updating with news stories about our campaigns, but also we write industry white papers about all sorts of stuff. So I wrote a piece on interactivity at scale and the future of programmatic. And
so that would be a great first resource for people to start looking at.
Absolutely. Yeah, we published quite a few things around the use of data. Neil wrote a piece at the beginning of the year, actually, our CEO, and he wrote a piece around the creative use of data. Mm-hmm. So people they'll find that on the website as well.
Hmm. All right, Dan Dawson, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode. I hope you enjoyed listening and that you learned something. If you want to stay on top of what's happening and actually matters in digital signage, join thousands of readers who visit 16.9, that's 16-9.net every day. 16.9 the blog and now the podcast are both properties of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare bedroom in my house near Toronto. Thanks to our podcast sponsor, ScreenFeed, and thank you for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.